Good afternoon. This is the Epic Storytelling Hour. You're listening to your story host, Fanny Crawford, on Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Today is Monday, February 27th. And because it's 12 noon, we know you're listening to Epic Storytelling Hour. Today, in our studio, we have with us storyteller Stash Sielkowski. Originally from Baltimore, late of Pittsburgh, and moving back to Maryland. Am I allowed to say that, Stash?
Sure.
Okay. Welcome.
Yeah. Actually, it's late of Arkansas.
Okay. We'll do that too. Late of Arkansas, soon to be late of Pittsburgh. And I think Stash is going to tell a story or two.
I will.
For us today. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to that, having heard many of Stash's stories before. But let's start out. Tell us about your move. Tell us about becoming a Marylander again.
My wife and I moved to Pittsburgh in 2012 because my mother-in-law needed help. And so we sold our home in Arkansas and bought hers.
Oh.
And we took care of her. She passed away in December.
And sorry, I think you did tell me about that. Condolences.
She's better off.
It was time.
Yes. And since we never intended to live in Pittsburgh, even though my wife is from Wilkinsburg, we decided, actually, this was my wife's idea. She thinks that I always do whatever she wants, which is true. I mean,
what a smart man you are.
Right? Why would I not? I'm married to a beautiful woman who treats me wonderfully.
She is a wonderful woman.
I'm the most spoiled man you have ever met. And she feels that I've done a lot for her and everything. And I have family in Maryland.
Yeah, yeah.
I have an 87-year-old sister in Baltimore, a 79-year-old brother on Eastern Shore near Ocean City, and my daughter lives in Westminster.
That's what I knew about. So
yeah. And my grandson Jack, who's going to be 5, and
it is all about Jack after all.
Yeah, it is all about Jack. So we're going to move, and we're going to get an apartment.
Very good.
And so we're downsizing.
So you'll be able to come to Shepherdstown, not only for Epic Radio to be on the air more regularly, but also for to participate or attend Adam Booth's Speak Story series.
Yes,
very
I will.
Good. I'm looking forward to that too. Although you've been pretty faithful about coming whenever you can.
I try.
So is Jack a budding storyteller too? Have you been working on him?
Yes. not on purpose to teach him to be a storyteller, but he is very, very vocal. And he does love to tell stories.
What kind of stories does he tell?
About things that happen, you know.
Experiences.
Experiences, everything. And just recently I sent to Jack, and I have other grandchildren, a picture that I drew of a tree and some water, and I drew about a half a dozen animals in the trees and colored them and put three men kind of like, oh, I don't know, gremlins or something, or maybe leprechauns behind a rock, just them peeking out.
Beginning of a story.
And I said, I was looking out on the back, I was looking out my window, and in this tree, I saw all these things, and maybe you could tell me what they were, and I don't know what these guys are doing behind the rock. So,
but Jack knew.
Well, he and his mother sat down with that, and he told his mother all about the animals and what they were, and he thought one of them was a very funny-looking something. Who wasn't sure. My drawing's not that great. And he even named the three guys.
All right.
You know?
So another few years, we'll have Jack on air with us.
Probably will.
Telling stories. Yeah. Very cool. Well, so you're moving to Westminster.
Right.
Do you have a calendar in mind? How soon can we count on you being available?
May 1st. That's the date. My wife keeps reminding me that, you know, they it may not be ready for us May 1st, but
that's a good target.
It is.
And that's a great time to move. I've moved in May before, and that is a wonderful time to start out anew in a new place. Watch the flowering trees and the
birds come back. I also have another reason for that. I've done a lot of theater.
Oh, yes. Okay. Talk about that, please. Well, tell your little anecdote, and then we can get into theater.
on May 12th, I have an audition for Beauty and the Beast. And
Beauty or Beast, Stosh?
Maurice, the father, okay. I'm hoping. So it's a perfect part.
Yeah, it is a perfect part.
I really hope I can get it because he's a dreamer and a tinkerer. He builds strange things, and I'd like to do stuff like that. So,
and he's very attached to his family.
Yes. And I don't want to have to audition from Pittsburgh.
Good
especially because if they call me back,
yeah,
and that company, I've worked with them in years past.
Oh.
And in fact, I did my first ever theater musical show with them.
So you were doing theater before you started doing improv, because what I know about
your work is
the improv work.
But the improv work is really minimal.
Well, it's impressive anyway, yeah. To me.
yeah, I started theater in 1985.
Before you were a storyteller?
I was telling stories, but not, I wasn't
performing.
Being a performing storyteller. I took my daughters to a lot of shows, and on the way home, I would always say, boy, that looked like fun. I'd like to do that. And one time, in 1985, on my dinner plate, I found an audition notice. And my oldest daughter said, you keep talking about it and you tell us we should do whatever we want to do. We should try stuff. So stop talking and go audition. and I did.
What was that part?
It was for Man of La Mancha. Mm-hmm. And I played Anselmo.
All right.
But I went to the audition and a guy got up. I sat in the back. I was in a high school auditorium. And a man got up and he sang The Impossible Dream. And I applauded, and all the other people sitting waiting to audition stared at me. And when it got quiet again, I left. I was so embarrassed,
you know,
because I was the only one who did. I was the only one who applauded. There were 50 people there. And I went home. My daughters fussed at me, so I went back the next night. And the people running the auditions said, I wonder what happened to you. We called your number. You weren't here. So I sang a song. I didn't know I was supposed to have a song prepared, but the lady at the piano said, come over here and I'll get you started. And so I sang and I got a role. I had a solo in the show. Yeah.
First time.
Yeah.
Too. So how long did you have that run? How long?
Well, it was just 2 weekends. It was a community theater,
mm-hmm.
and it was 6 shows. And
but you got the bug. You had the bug.
Oh, I was. Since then, I've been I've been involved either as a director or performer. I've produced a lot of shows, well over 100 shows.
So, and some of those were with kids at the high schools?
For 4 years, I did Frederick High School's evening drama.
Okay.
And I directed all the musicals.
This is Frederick, Maryland. We're talking about. Yeah.
But the other times I've in Arkansas, I had my own theater company and we did 30 shows in 6 years.
So you are an organizer as well as a performer, because I know you've also organized storytelling festivals.
Right.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
Well,
that's really put
when
your
I
name
got,
on the map.
When I got interested in storytelling, a student of mine in the 80s ladies called me and said, would you come and tell some stories at our art camp? She and her husband had started a performance space in two houses that they bought on the main street of Reisterstown, Maryland, which was near the high school where I was teaching. And I said, well, you know, I don't know if I can tell stories like that. And she said, oh, you told stories every day in class. So I, you know,
she
I
knew.
Did. She knew me well. Her name was Beth. She was very nice. And so I started telling at their camp. And it was really exciting and interesting and that. And at the same time, I was doing theater. And I did a couple of shows for them. And I really got the bug. Mm. I was teaching full-time, coaching three seasons. And a number of years, I did as many as six shows.
Oh, my.
And I just, you know, I really fell in love with, I like entertaining people.
Like I can tell. You know, that comes so through. I think you like seeing people happy.
Yes, I do. I like to see them, give them a couple hours of pleasure.
Yeah.
When I moved to Arkansas, I had already been to Jonesboro a number of times.
Oh, so and you had so seen it work.
I'd seen, you know, how great it was. It took me 2 years to convince the mayor and the man who was in charge of the community club, which was the community organization. And mm-hmm. Everybody had to belong to the community club. Took me 2 years of talking to say, we should have a storytelling festival. And so finally, the mayor gave me $2,500. And because I had a theater company, I was able to raise a lot of others by doing shows just where I split the money with the library. And during the years I was there, we raised over $40,000 for the library. Nobody got paid for doing the shows. But a lot of the money we raised also went to the festival. And the first year we had Connie Reagan Blake, Elizabeth Ellis, John Spellman, and Jim May. And
so had you met them at Jonesboro, or you just cold called them?
I had seen Elizabeth and Connie at Jonesboro. I hadn't seen Jim May, but John Spellman, I had gone to Silver Spring, Maryland.
Right.
To his classes.
Well, these are all very big names on the national scene.
I got to be friends with John, and over the years, I've hired John for four or five different things, workshops and school.
John was performing in Frederick last weekend or the weekend before, I think, for the first time in a long time. Wow. That's nice.
Yeah, and he's a great guy.
Yeah,
he's
done, he is a really nice guy.
He's, you know, done a lot of nice things. So I put up a couple tents, and people came, and they had a great time. They never heard of storytelling before. I had started doing it in the community, but they didn't know that other people did it. They thought,
you were just an aberration.
Which was strange for Arkansas. They never had a storytelling festival in Arkansas. I couldn't believe it when I found that out. No place in the state had a storytelling
festival. They still had enough of that at home. It was not yet crossing generations. No.
So that's still going on.
Yeah, I remember hearing that.
It's still going on. In fact, this past October, I was one of the tellers.
Performers, yeah. And what's the name of that festival?
It's called Fairfield Bay Story Fest.
Okay, I think you sent me an email at some point.
Probably. I'm sure I did.
Good introduction to your work. Well, now that you're in our region, I'm sure you're going to be kept busy performing and organizing, if we can talk you into that. And I know also that you're a member of the West Virginia Storytelling Guild.
Yes.
So does Westminster put you in any closer to regular gatherings?
Yes.
So we'll see more of you there as well. Very good.
Yes.
All of those things are things to look forward to. Well, let me do a quick station identification, and then I'm going to do a calendar update, because I usually do that towards the beginning of the show. And then I'm hoping that you'll share one of your stories with us.
Okay.
Does that work for you?
Yes.
All right. Listeners, we're talking with Stash Zielkowski, originally from Baltimore, late of Arkansas, and late of Pittsburgh, or soon to be late. He's correcting me. because Stash is moving to Westminster, Maryland, and he'll be closer to Shepherdstown and able to come to speak Adam Booth's story venue on a more regular basis. But right now, you're listening to Fanny Crawford, your storytelling host, and Stash Zielkowski on Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio Storytelling Hour in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And if you're overhearing us on somebody else's internet device, please pull us up on your own at www.enlightenradio.org. I usually do a calendar update of story performances and workshops in the region. So I will start with April 18th. Adam Booth's Speaks series comes back from winter hiatus on April 18th. Generally, that series runs the second Tuesday of every month, April through December. But in April, Adam's going to run that session on the third Tuesday, April 18th, because we have Antonio Hosha coming in. Wonderful storyteller, mime. You get a full body experience when you come to see and hear Antonio Hosha on stage. And you're going to want to get your tickets early, because that show may very well sell out at the Shepherdstown Community Building or the Shepherdstown War Memorial Building, however you're familiar with that center on German Street or Main Street. That'll be 7:30 on April 18th. And to get your tickets in advance, you can go to www.speakwv.org or email Adam at info@speakwv.org. Or if you're a traditionalist, you can call him at 304-886-9481. And I'm not sure if the tickets are available quite yet, but generally they're also available at the Four Seasons Bookstore on Main Street or German Street. So you can try all of those ways, but make sure you register in advance, because we don't want you standing outside hearing Antonio doing his wonderful performance and you're not there. I don't have the roster of the additional sessions through December for 2017, but I'm guessing if they're not up on Adam's website quite yet, they will be very shortly. So you should certainly check www.speakwv.org. In Hagerstown, beginning almost the same time, April 24th, the fourth Monday of the month, Stories in the Round starts up again after our winter break. And our first storyteller on April 24th will be Eloise Schottler, who's coming back to Stories in the Round for the first time in 3 years to do another World War I performance. She was with us back in December 2014, I guess, doing her story about World War I nurses who trained with Johns Hopkins School of Nursing and went overseas, sent by General Pershing in 1917 to take care of injured Americans in France. I'm sorry, that's the story she's going to be telling. I'm thinking while I'm talking, and that is always very dangerous for me. I need to just speak from rote, or I get really mixed up. So April 24th, Eloise will be telling Ready to Serve, the story of nurses from Johns Hopkins University, then called School of Nursing, who were sent overseas by General Pershing. These are the first American women recruited to serve in the military overseas, and they really paved the way for women in the military in our time. So Eloise has biographical information. She does a composite of some of these 64 women who ranged in age from 18 to their 40s and really were sometimes in over their heads. Some of them were kind of naive about what they were going into in wartime, but they made quite a contribution and saved thousands of lives there in 1917, 1918. So Eloise will be there on April 24th, and that will kick off our season. You can contact me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638 to register in advance, $10 in advance, $12 at the door. You can also contact me, email fanitsky@hotmail.com, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y @hotmail.com. And we'll look forward to seeing you. Please tell us that you're a listener when you come, so I can put faces to those people out there. Also, coming up in March, almost this month, not quite this month, just one more day, and then we'll be in March. Eileen Evans, West Virginia storyteller, will be portraying Aslanda Robeson, who you may know as the wife of Paul Robeson, actor and singer. Aslanda Robeson was an artist and a writer in her own right, and she will be talking with Pearl S. Buck, portrayed by Karen Varanch, across from Eileen Evans at Eastern West Virginia Community and Technical College on March 22nd, 12:15 in the afternoon. You can contact Eileen Evans directly for more information, 304-288-6255. That's 304-288-6255, or go to the website of Voices from the Earth. That's the organization that Eileen Evans is part of, and these performances are sponsored by Voices from the Earth, vfte.org, to reach her through the website. And then on April 23rd, the day before Eloise comes to the Unitarian Universalist Church in Hagerstown to do her Ready to Serve performance for Stories in the Round, I will be doing a service at Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown at 13245 Searfoss Pike at the west end of town. And I'll be talking about John Chapman, a.k.a. Johnny Appleseed, and the connection to Unitarian principles. And we'll do a water ceremony as part of that service. So that's on a Sunday, April 23rd at 10:45 in the morning. And then the next day, we hope you come back to Hagerstown to hear Eloise tell on Monday evening at 7. That's all the calendar I'm going to do right now, although we may have a couple more time for a couple more things later on. But I want to make sure we get Stosh to tell a story this afternoon. Stosh Zilkowski is our storyteller guest this afternoon. Stosh, you can just take it away, or do you want to introduce your story first?
The title I would give a story is called The Kitten.
The Kitten, okay. All right.
When my girls, I have two daughters, one who just turned 48 this past week, and the other one who is going to be 45 soon.
Ah, youth.
Yes. Well, when my daughters were young, I was living with my first wife, and their mother loved cats, and so the girls loved cats, and it got to a point in our house where everybody loved cats, but Dad was the one who took care of cats who got run over or got hurt or went looking for them when they disappeared or cleaned up after them in the house. And so I made a rule that they could not live in the house. And it was winter time. I built a hotel for the cats on the back porch. I got real sturdy cardboard. I made it two levels. It would hold about 10 cats.
actually. And I put a blanket over the front of it with some slits in it. And I put a light bulb, a 20-watt light bulb, in each floor, in each level. And so that no matter how cold outside it got, it was pretty toasty inside those cardboard boxes. And they were decent size. Well, every once in a while, there was a new kitten. And this was just before Christmas. There was a snowstorm. And I was in the basement doing some work. And I always had a workshop wherever I've lived. And I was building something, working on something. And the girls came down and said, "Daddy, the kitten is gone." And I said it went off the porch just to run around a little bit. No, it's snowing. There's a storm. It's snowing, and the kitten is gone, and there are no footprints, and she's not with the other cats. So he went out, bundled up, went outside, and it was snowing. It was had been snowing for a couple hours, and I started to look for the kitten, and I actually heard a cry, which I won't try to imitate. I did try that once in a story, and it sounded sounded like a dinosaur or something, I guess. So anyway, the house that we lived in was on one level, but it was on the side of a slope, and so there was a back door that went into a basement. And in the front of the house, there was a sloping hill that went up to a road. In the back of the house, it sloped down and went to a creek, surrounded by woods and a small country road at that slopey part. So I heard a sound of kitten, and it sounded like it was coming from up the road. So I walked up the hill. When I got near the top where the road was, it sounded like it was coming from down by the creek. So I went down by the creek, and then when I got past the house and towards the creek, I stopped and listened. It sounded like it was coming from the hill again. I did that two or three times before it dawned on me, I was a science teacher, Mr. Science, that I was hearing it from two different directions because it was in a tall tree right above me. And whenever I moved away from the tree, it sounded like it was. So I could see the kitten. I had a flashlight. It was about 30, 35 feet up in the tree. I went back to the porch, and the girls were at the back door. I told them, I said, "The kitten's in the tree. He'll come down soon. You know, he's not going to stay up there all night." And it was crying, and what if he falls, and please get the kitten. And all. So I went to the basement, got my extension ladder. I didn't realize it was how high the kitten was. I had an extension ladder that would go up to about 24 feet. I put it against the tree. Had a little bit of trouble because it was aluminum, sliding on the steps going up in my boots. I got as far as I could up the ladder, and I still couldn't reach the limb. It was a good 10 feet above me or so. So I told the girls, I can't do anything. I don't have a ladder big enough. Well, you could do, I know you can find some way to do it. So I'd worked a lot in different things, summer jobs and construction. So I went in the basement and I cut some pieces of 2x4, about 30 inches long. I got a bag of nails, a hammer, went out and nailed some cross pieces onto the tree. And it was snowing the whole time. And I got to where I could get closer and closer to the kitten. But I swear the kitten was being paid, because as I got closer to the kitten went higher in the tree. And by now, I was really irritated with the kitten, and I was not going to let the kitten win. So I got off the ladder, went in the house and I found a wicker basket that we use for laundry. I tied a rope across it, made a loop, got a longer piece of rope, tied it, got myself a long pole, went out and climbed up. I had tied a kind of a piece of metal onto the end of the rope. So hanging onto the boards and the tree, I flung the end of the rope high above the kitten. And luckily, it only took a couple tries, and that heavy piece of metal took the rope over. It dropped down. I had the other end of the rope tied to that wicker basket. And I began pulling it very slowly, this wicker basket kind of elevator going up to where the kitten was. And when it got near the kitten, I took the pole that I had and tapped the kitten and knocked him into the basket. I began to lower the basket down. When it got to just about eye level, the kitten crawled out of the basket, jumped onto my head, and then down to the ground, 20-some feet, up onto the porch. Well, I got down off of the ladder and just left everything else there, because by then I was wet. It was a heavy snow. The girls were happy. I could hear them through the door. They had the kitten in the house, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to say no kittens in the house now, because they were so happy and the kitten was saved. And it took me a while to go to the basement, get the wet clothes off, and get myself ready to go upstairs. And I was feeling pretty like, you know, here it is. I did all this work. They're upstairs having a great time. And when I went up the cellar steps and opened the door that went into the hallway near the living room, the girls had heard me coming up, I guess, and they were standing at the door with a cup of hot chocolate and a plate of cookies and a little sign that said, "You're the best dad."
Oh. So, Dad learned a lesson? Is that what you're telling us?
Yes. So, and it was a very nice feeling. The girls were very happy about the kitten.
What a great dad.
And recently, in visiting my daughter, I stopped by that house. My ex-wife still lives there. And we're friendly. Mm-hmm. And I stopped by. She wasn't home, or I don't even know if she was home. I just parked and looked in the woods, and those boards are still there.
On the tree.
Yeah, because, nobody does anything in those woods. It's a small place.
So, they probably don't even know they're there.
No, I'm sure that really nobody's paid attention to it. So,
have you become a cat lover?
No.
No.
No, but we did have a cat in Pittsburgh until my mother-in-law moved to a senior facility. She had a cat when we moved in. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not a cat lover. I don't hate them, but
they're a lot of work.
They're a lot of work, and the home we have is a manufactured home, so things like windowsills are very narrow.
Yeah,
and that's but. Katie liked to sit on the windowsill, and she was so chubby, she often would slide off. So my mother-in-law asked me if I could fix something to make that possible for her to sit in a window. So I cut boards and put new windowsills in throughout the house so that Katie could go and look out and watch the birds and stuff. And I even put cat doors in my mother-in-law's bedroom and the laundry room, so that Katie could go in and out whenever she wanted. And
so you're not a cat lover, but you're an enabler.
Oh, yes. I had a lot of practice because of my daughters.
For those of us who are overly attached to our animals, yeah. you just help.
Yeah. Yes, I don't dislike pets. I'm not good about pets because I really am not good at all about losing things. So when they die, I suffer.
Yeah.
And and I didn't, you know. I'm too selfish, I guess.
Well, thank you for that story, Stosh. I'm going to tell our listeners who they're listening to. We have storyteller Stosh Silkowski with us today. This is Fanny Crawford, your storytelling host on Epic Storytelling Hour on Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And you can listen to us on your own internet device at www.enlightenradio.org. So, when you came to tell stories at Stories in the Round back in December 2015, mm-hmm. I think I have that date right, you brought an entourage with you. Now, this was a surprise to you. You didn't know that these people were going to show up, but at that time, when you came to tell stories at Stories in the Round, that was the largest audience we had ever had. It was about 60 people. And I think everybody who had ever been there before was awed that you attracted that many people, that people came from three states in the District of Columbia to hear you tell. And some of those people who drove all that way were students of yours from 30 and more years ago. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. It was clear to everybody in the room that storytelling is an act of love for you, that you make this amazing connection with your audience, and that people remember you. So even though you didn't initially know most of these people as a storyteller, they knew you as a storyteller because you were using stories in the classroom with us, with them, or as a coach. Some right. of them were not your classroom students, but your coaching students. So I've been wanting to ask you ever since then, what motivated you to start telling stories and to think about storytelling as a way to connect with people? Because it's clear you've understood that from the beginning.
When I first started teaching in 1967, I taught at a private school, a boys' Catholic high school, a school that I attended. Mm-hmm. However, it had changed. I attended it in the middle of Baltimore City. We had no grounds. We had a courtyard that was cement. And it was just a building. It was actually going right across the street from the Enoch Pratt Central Library and uh-huh. The old cathedral.
Uh-huh.
Well, after I left that school, I went in the Army, then I went to college, and then I worked for a year, and I wanted a coach. So I went and applied for my old soccer coach's position because he had died. And someone had already been hired. Mm. But the vice principal, Brother John, told me that I could get to be an assistant coach immediately if I would teach chemistry. Because he saw, and I had to present them with a resume, and he saw that I had a degree in chemistry. And at the time, I was pondering a job at NASA. Mm. I was working at NASA, and I had been offered a full-time job in Goddard, College Park.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because I wanted a coach, I turned down a job that was $2,500 more than teaching, and I started teaching chemistry. And I seriously, from the first day, I fell in love with it. I just, things that I had trouble with started to make more sense because I was explaining it. And I found out that over the first couple of weeks that if I told just a little anecdote about a scientist, Linus Pauling or Einstein or somebody who had made some difference, there was a difference in the classroom,
mm-hmm.
especially in that school system. I mean, in that private school, it was the best method of teaching that I remember. We taught two large groups.
twice a week, this same group. And the other chemistry teacher, who was my boss, he taught the rest of the chemistry students on two other periods. They were lectures, like in college, no questions. And then I had 17 small groups throughout the week of 20 minutes apiece, where they came in the door, sat down, and had questions.
Oh,
and all we did was answer questions, just questions, no philosophy, no things. And so during those lectures, I realized that if I put a story in, you know, pretty much at the beginning about where we were going with the ideas, they really paid more attention and seemed more interesting.
Sure.
And so from then on, before every class, when I introduced a new topic, I looked for a scientist or something, even in the news.
Mm.
And when I also taught math later in my career, and I did the same thing with math. I learned that, you know, doing some tricks with numbers, it just made the class much better. And I've always done that. Now it's just part of who I am. Stories.
Well, it makes clear your love of the subject comes through loud and clear. So
yeah, and it worked in coaching too. I just, you know, I coached track for 19 years, and I did.
Those kids these were 40-year-old people who were coming in the door at Stories in the Round, and they were just so thrilled to see you, to see that you were going to be appearing. They had driven all this way to surprise you. You didn't even know they were coming.
Three of those men that came in, one graduated in 79, one graduated in 76, and one graduated in the 80s, just before I stopped coaching. And I have a great picture of standing with them. I look like a little old man, these great big eyes. I am fortunate. You know, one of the things I love about Facebook is I have hundreds of my former students and athletes that I'm in contact with.
I've seen them on Facebook.
You know, and I can remember their birthdays. I remember mine. That's the best use for me. That's the best thing about Facebook, that I can stay connected with.
Yeah, and they can find you.
And, you know, and they like stories. Athletes love stories too, you know.
So what do you want to share with us next? Do you have another story you've been saving?
I have two. I have a real short one.
Okay.
And a new story.
Okay.
Okay, the short one is about my youngest daughter. Both of my daughters were wonderful students. I was very fortunate. Their mother loved reading, was a good influence on them. In our house, I was always doing homework, preparing for classes, and so they saw me. I did my work right at the table with them lots of times. And so school was very important to them. Reading was important. Grades were important to them. And once my oldest daughter told me this is a little side thing. I once sat at the table and said to some friends at a party, they were extolling the virtues of my daughters who had straight A's and had both graduated first in all their schools. And I said, well, the girls just love studying and they like that. I never expected them to get A's. And my oldest daughter cleared her throat and said, are you kidding me? I said, what? She said, how could anybody live with you and not know that you have to do your best? And I said, I never said that. So anyway, this is about Mara. When Mara was in about fourth or fifth grade, she came home one day and had a paper she was very upset about. I came home from after school coaching, and my wife said, I think you need to have a talk with Mara. She's in her room. She's upset. She's been crying. And she didn't even want to talk to me about that. She said, you're going to be very disappointed or something. So I went and talked to her, and she had this paper, and
It was a 49 at the top of the page. And so I said, you know, let's go take a walk. Well, luckily, the place where we lived, it's really nice. We had a path through the woods, and I had put up a swing and everything. So we went and took a walk together. And I spent the next 20 minutes or so telling her how important it is to be able to fail at things, and that you'd learn from that, and that it was a good lesson. And I ended this long philosophical talk with, just think, you had your first failure, and now you don't have to worry about it. It's over. It doesn't make any difference. You'll never have your first failure again. And it kind of cheered her up. We came back, and my wife was even impressed that, you know, Mara was smiling again. And so the next day I came home from coaching, and Mara met me at the door. Said she was looked sad, and she said, "Dad, that 49 was out of 50. I had the highest mark, and now I have to worry about that failure again."
So, nice going, Dad.
I know. I thought so much for all of my philosophy. So, anyway.
That's really funny. Yes.
And Mara, my daughter, likes to tell that story. And she's very good at embellishing our walk.
And how it went on and on and on.
Yeah, yes. So, recently I did a workshop. Well, last year I did a workshop with Lynn Ford, and so a great storyteller. And it was in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I got to perform at her performance the night before. They had picked two people from the West Virginia Guild to perform on the stage with her.
Oh.
And I was one of them.
Okay.
And, you know, I pulled names out of the hat or something, I guess. But during the workshop, she was emphasizing that it's okay to change stories, and that, you know, not everybody tells Little Red Riding Hood the same way. And things, and she talked about how she would hear something from her grandfather and go and tell her father what her grandfather told her, and her father would say, "That's not the way it was." And he would tell her a different version. So, and she encouraged us, you know, change stories around, you know, don't change them so much that they're not the same story, but, you know. And I've been thinking about that, and there's a story that I really love that I got years ago. I found a book called The Jewish Book of Humor, and it's got all kind of wonderful stand-up comedy routines in it, and
wow,
things that are not the whole routine, but by famous guys, Maury Amsterdam, and people who performed many years ago, and it has lots of little stories. Well, there's this one story that is about a magic fruit. And I thought about that, and I liked that. I told it a number of times, and I thought, I would like to do something different about it. I'd like to make it modern, because this is about a princess, and it's about sons of royalty and all that. So this is my version, my modernized version, and I have never performed this. I did tell it at a guild meeting in Pittsburgh, but I've never actually performed it, so this will be the first time
I've
doing it.
Yes. All right, good. So,
and I even made a couple notes, which I don't usually do, but I
notes are fine.
I just wanted to remember a couple words. The four of them were friends. Three boys and a girl. They'd gone to the same school since kindergarten. And they were all really good students and had lots of fun. They weren't perfect kids. They occasionally got in trouble. But they were like the four musketeers. Three guys and a girl. And they did lots of things together. When they graduated from high school, on the last day, they made a pact. And they said that they would meet in 10 years and they would see where they were in their life. Because each one of them over the years had expressed that they didn't want to get married young. They wanted to see what they would accomplish in the world and then maybe settle down. And it was no secret that each one of the boys was interested in Jessica. Well, they went their separate ways and went to school and had careers. And David invented something that was incredible. It was based on things that were already in use, but he invented a system that took the idea of the cars that drove themselves beyond that. He created a thing called the civilian quad drone. It was a machine that could fly and carry four people. It had a glass kind of dome over it. And you didn't have to do anything to actually fly it. What you did was log into the computer, contact the central area that was in charge of his company, tell them where you wanted to go, they would program it, and you would be off. They'd give you a time to be there, get in the machine, and you would fly. And it was well regulated, didn't have to go very high, just had to be able to go over buildings and in the city and stuff, but all the paths had been worked out. And it turned out he was smart enough to realize that you didn't have to worry about streets like the Uber drivers did and bridges and stoplights and things, because the skyways were pretty clear, especially if you didn't have to go into the traffic from airports and things. Well, Charles, his studies went in a kind of different way, but still sort of relying on some things with the internet, because they had both grown up in this modern age. He invented the crystal, and he spelled it a funny way. He used the K instead of the C, and the crystal was a device that you could actually see through. It was a cube. You could see through it. But there were things inside that were controls of some kind, you know, miniaturization down to the atomic level. And the cube was amazing. It was better than the internet. You didn't have to type anything. You could speak to it, ask it questions. It could give you answers. You could ask it to show you things. It would show you things in real time. It was like a crystal ball from the ancients. You could run a meeting, bring the cube with you, sit it on the table. As long as you had a screen or a wall, you could project things from the cube in any direction. And you could talk to anybody on the planet, because it worked just like a phone. You could actually ask it to look at places, and you could see what was going on in certain cities or buildings even. Well, the third boy, Daniel, he studied medicine, and he became very interested in what happens when people die. Some of the people he worked with thought it was very morbid because he was so involved with death. But he had gotten the idea to work on this because of the drug when he was a young man that the police began using for people who had overdoses from drug addicts that could save a life. When he took his research a bit further, he discovered something about the human body that a person who died, even what was considered a natural death, wasn't really gone immediately. And so he had developed a drug that could almost bring someone back from the dead. It was that powerful. Didn't work 100% of the time, but it actually could be used when people who were in a terrible accident, normally they would be put into an ambulance, taken away, and taken to the morgue. Sometimes his drug would actually be able to save them. Jessica was the adventurer in their group. She traveled the world. As a young person, right after high school, she didn't bother going to college. She had gotten some money from her grandmother to go to Europe and try looking around and seeing things. And she never went home again. She just traveled. She did different things. She learned to dance. She learned to sing. She became a performer. And she went to different countries and tried performing in different ways. And sometimes she wasn't very careful about where she went and some of the things she learned. She tried drugs, all kind of experimental things. She was the wild one in the group. Well, when it got to the day where they had decided that they would meet in their 10-year reunion, the boys all showed up at the prearranged place, and she wasn't there. Well, they knew where she was supposed to be before she got there, and Charles used his cube and looked into it and made a contact, and they discovered that she was in a hospital. She was in a coma. And the doctors expected her to die. Well, they were able to get into the Citizen Quad drone and go to that hospital. And when they got there, Daniel was able to use his drug and brought her out of the coma. And the three men talked to her and said, "You should stop what you've been doing with your life. You should make a decision. You should marry one of us. I can take you any place." David said, "I can take you any place in the world. You never have to worry about paying for tickets or doing this and that. We can fly in my machine." And Charles said, "I can show you anything. You don't even have to leave your house. You can take all the time in the world to recover, and we can use my cube, and you can do everything you want by just looking and finding things you want to try." And Daniel said, "I saved your life with my life's work with the drug." And so now, at the end of my story, I have a question for my audience. Who should she marry? Should she marry David or Charles or Daniel? Or should she make another choice? And with this story, I plan on using it in an audience where I will ask them that question at the end. And when I told it at the guild meeting, it was very interesting because a couple of people actually made choices. And a woman who was there for the first time said, "She doesn't have to marry any of them. She doesn't owe them anything. She didn't ask them for that. She should just stay on her own and do whatever she wants." So the original story was about a fruit that one of the three brothers found. And when he picked it off of this tree, another one appeared. And when he reached for that, the second one, a man appeared at his shoulder and said, "No, you only get one." that one's for somebody else. And so when he met his two brothers, one of them had traveled and found a crystal ball, and he could see things, and he saw a princess in a faraway place who was sick and dying. And the other brother who had traveled had found a magic carpet. And he said, "We can get on my carpet. We can go to her." And so they did. And when they got there, the brother who had gotten the pomegranate broke it open and fed some of it to her. And she was cured. So, and that is from the Jewish folktale.
What a lovely story. And I love how you've updated it. And I want to hear how your audiences respond when you begin telling us.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to telling that in a...
That's lovely. We are out of time, listeners. That was Stasz Silkowski with an updated traditional Jewish story brought into the 21st century. And I hope that you get to hear that story live sometime and to be in one of Stasz's audiences and give him feedback about what your answer would be when he asks that final question. You've been listening to Stasz Silkowski, our storytelling guest today on the Epic Storytelling Hour, and your story host, Fanny Crawford. Stay tuned. We will be hearing Moby Dick recorded and broadcast on Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio next up. 14 minutes with music in between. So 14 minutes from now, you'll hear Moby Dick. The Epic Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand our own stories. Thanks for listening, and tune in next Monday at 12 noon. Talk to you then. Bye-bye.